Chapter 7. The imaginary presence of Vallas, whose name Nicholas had been forced to make up for want of a real one, had made him into what he was not. Had he gone to a psychiatrist, he would still be what he was, and he would stay what he was. The psychiatrist would have focused his attention on the origin of the voice, not on its intentions or on the results. That very psychiatrist was probably still living in Berkeley. No nocturnal voices, no invisible presence sketching out a happier life would have plagued him. How undisturbed the sleep of the foolish. "Okay, Nick," I said. "You win." "Pardon?" He glanced at me a little wearily. "Oh, I see. Yes, I guess I win. Phil, how could I have stayed in Berkeley so long? Why did it take someone else, another voice, not mine, to goad me into life? Why was that necessary?" I said. "The incredible part is not that I heard Vallas, listened to Vallas, and moved here, but that without him, or them, I wouldn't have contemplated it, let alone done it. Phil, the idea of leaving Berkeley, quitting my job with Herb Jackman, it wouldn't even have entered my mind." "Yeah, that is the incredible part," I agreed. He was right. It said something about the normal trajectory of human existence, homo unimpeded, allowed to trudge out his circular course, like a wedge of dead rock circling a dead sun, mindless and purposeless, deaf to the universe at large, as blind as it was cold. Something into which no new idea ever came, barred forever from originality. It made you stop and reflect. Nicholas said, "Whoever they are, Phil, I have no choice but to trust them. I'm going to be doing what they want anyhow." "I think you'll know," I said, "when your programming fires." If indeed, sobering thought, he had been programmed. "You suppose I'll notice? I'll be too busy to notice." That chilled me, the thought of him in action all at once, blurring as if possessing 16 arms. "They," Nicholas continued. "I wish you wouldn't call them they," I said. "It makes me nervous. I'd be a lot less nervous if you'd say he." "It's the joke about the 5,000-pound canary. Where does it sleep?" Nicholas said.
"Anywhere it wants."
"I call them they," Nicholas said, "because I've seen more than one of them. A woman, a man. Two for openers, and two is they."
"What'd they look like?"
After a pause, Nicholas said, "Of course, you realize these were dreams, and dreams are distorted. The conscious mind sets up a barrier
to protect itself," I finished.
Nicholas said, "They had three eyes, the normal two, and then one with a lens, not a pupil, dead center in the forehead. That third eye witnessed everything. They could turn it on and off, and when it was off, it was entirely gone, invisible. And during that time," he took a deep, shuddering breath, "they looked just like us. We never guessed." He became silent.
"Oh, good God," I said aloud.
"Yep,"
Nicholas said stoically. "Did they speak?"
"They were mute and deaf. They were in round chambers like bathyspheres, with lots of wires running to them like electronic booster equipment, communications equipment, phone-type wires. The wires and boosters were so they could communicate with us, so their thoughts would form words we could hear and understand, and so they could hear us back. It was difficult, a strain for them."
"I don't know if I want to hear this."
"Hell, you write about it all the time. I've been reading some of your novels, finally."
"You writing fiction," I said. "It's all fiction."
"Their craniums were enlarged," Nicholas said.
"What?"
I was having trouble following him. It was too much for me. "To accommodate the third eye. Massive craniums. A wholly different skull shape from ours. Very long. The Egyptian pharaoh had it. Akhenaten, and Akhenaten's two daughters, but not his wife. It was hereditary on his side." I opened the bedroom door and walked back into the living room, where Rachel sat reading. "He's crazy," Rachel said remotely, not looking up from her book.
"Right," I said. "Completely. Nothing left. Only thing is, I don't want to be here when his programming fires."
She said nothing. She turned a page. Following me out of the bedroom, Nicholas approached the two of us. He held a piece of paper toward me for me to see. This is a sign they showed me several times. Two intersecting arcs arranged, well, you can see. It's a little like the Christian fish sign, the side of the fish with the arcs forming its body. The interesting thing is, if an arc intersects once... From the design on the extended piece of paper, a pinkish-purple beam of light, an inch in diameter, fired upward into Nicholas's face. He shut his eyes, grimaced with pain, dropped the sheet of paper, and swiftly put his hand to his forehead. All of a sudden, he said thickly, I have the most violent headache. Didn't you see that beam of light? I said. Rachel had set down her book and was on her feet. Nicholas removed his hand from his forehead, opened his eyes, and blinked. I'm blind, he said. Silence. The three of us stood there, unmoving. I can see phosphine activity now, he said presently. An afterlight. No, I didn't see any beam of light, but I see a phosphine circle. It's pink. Now I can make out a few things. Rachel moved toward him, took him by the shoulder.
You'd better sit down.
In an odd, even voice, almost mechanical in quality, Nicholas intoned, Rachel, Johnny has a birth defect.
The doctor said nothing at all.
He has a right inguinal strangulated hernia. It's already gone down into the scrotal sac. The hydrocele is broken. Johnny needs immediate surgery. Go to the phone, pick it up, and dial Dr. Evanston. Tell him you're bringing Johnny into the emergency room at St. Jude Hospital in Fullerton. Tell him to be there.
Tonight?
Rachel said, appalled. Nicholas intoned. He is in imminent danger of death. With his eyes shut, he then repeated it, word for word, exactly as he had said it. Watching him, I got the impression suddenly that even though his eyes were shut, he was seeing the words. He spoke as if reading them off a cue card, like a performer. It was not his tone of voice, his cadence. He was following words written out for him. I accompanied them to the hospital. Rachel drove. Nicholas was still having trouble with his eyes, so he sat beside her holding the little boy. Their physician, Dr. Evanston, very irritable, met them at the emergency room. First he told them that he had examined Johnny several times for possible herniation and found nothing. Then he took Johnny off. Time passed. Dr. Evanston eventually returned and said noncommittally that there was indeed a right inguinal hernia, reducible but needing immediate surgery, since there was always the possibility of strangulation. On the way back to the Placentia apartment, I said, Who are these people?
Friends, Nicholas said.
They certainly are interested in your welfare, I said, and your babies.
Nothing wrong can happen, Nicholas said.
I said, But such powers!
They transferred information to my head, Nicholas said. But they didn't heal Johnny.
They healed him, I said. Getting him to the doctor and calling the doctor's attention to the birth defect was healing him. Why exert supernatural powers when natural curative means lay at hand? I remembered something the Buddha said after he witnessed a supposed saint walk on water. For a penny, the Buddha said, I can board a ferry and do that. It was more practical even for the Buddha to cross the water normally. The normal and the supernormal were not antagonistic realms, after all. Nicholas had missed the point. But he seemed dazed. As Rachel drove through the darkness, he continued to massage his forehead and eyes.
The information was transferred simultaneously, Nicholas said. Not sequentially. It's always that way. It's what's called analog in computer science in contrast to digital. You're sure they're friends?
Rachel said sharply.
Anyone who saves my boy's life, Nicholas said, is a friend.
I said, If they could convey all that exact information directly to your head like that, in one burst of colored light, they could let you know any time they want who they are, where they are from, and what they intend. Any confusion on your part regarding any of those issues is deliberate withholding of knowledge on their part. They don't want you to know.
If I knew, I'd tell people, Nicholas said. They don't want to see...
Why not? I said.
It would defeat their purpose, Nicholas said after a pause. They're working against...
He ceased talking then. There's a great deal you haven't told me, I said, that you know about them.
It's all on the written pages. He was silent for a few blocks and then said, They're working against great odds, so it follows that they have to operate with great caution, or it will fail.
He did not elaborate. He probably didn't know any more. Most of what he believed probably consisted of shrewd guesses, hatched out over long months of pondering. I had worked up a little speech to give. Now I gave it. "There is a slight chance," I said, "admittedly a very slight one, that what you're dealing with is religious, that in fact you are being informed by the Holy Spirit, which is a manifestation of God. We're all from Berkeley, raised there and limited by the secular viewpoint of a college town. We're not inclined to theological speculation. But healing is a typical miracle of the Holy Spirit, or so I understand. You ought to know about that, Nicholas, from having been a Quaker."
"Yes," he nodded. "When the Holy Spirit takes you over, it does heal."
"Heard any non-English languages in your head?" I asked him. "That you don't know?" Presently he nodded.
"Yes, in my dreams."
"Glossolalia," I said.
"Koine Greek. I wrote down a few words phonetically, what I could, when I woke up. Rachel took a year of Greek. She recognized them. We both looked them up in her dictionary. Koine Greek."
"Is that still..."
"It qualifies. In the book of Acts in the Bible, other races recognized what the apostles were saying in their own tongues at Pentecost when the Spirit first descended on them. Glossolalia isn't nonsense. It's foreign tongues you never knew. The Spirit brings them to your head so you can preach the gospel to every nation. It's generally misunderstood. I thought it was gibberish until I researched it."
"You've been reading the Bible?" I asked. "During your research?"
"The New Testament and the prophetic books." Rachel said, "Nick never knew any Greek. He was sure they weren't real words."
The cruel, biting quality had left her voice. Worry about Johnny and shock had done it.
"Nick very cautiously told a couple of people interested in the occult about dreaming in Greek, and they said, 'It's a past life. You're the reincarnation of a Greek-speaking person.' But I don't think that's it."
"What do you think it is?" I asked her.
"I don't know. The Greek words were the first thing that signified anything to me, that I ever took seriously about this. And now tonight is diagnosing Johnny. And I saw that pinkish-purple spark of light beamed up at him for an instant. I just don't know, Phil. It doesn't fit anything I've ever heard of. Nick seems to be catching glimpses of benign supernatural manipulators of some kind we don't know about. Just cryptic glimpses, what they want him to see. Not enough to extrapolate on. I get the impression they're very old. From the Koine Greek, which is 2,000 years out of the past. If they lapse into that, maybe there's your one inadvertent clue."
In a hoarse voice, Nicholas said abruptly,
"Someone is waking up in me. After 2,000 years, or almost that long. He's not awake yet, but his time is coming. He's been promised it a long time ago, when he was alive like us."
"Is he human?" I said.
"Oh, yes," Nicholas nodded. "Or he was once. The programming they're giving me, it's to wake him. They're having trouble, or anyhow it's very difficult. It takes a lot of things to do it. This man, this person is important to them. I don't know why. I don't know who the man is. I don't know what he'll do."
He lapsed into brooding silence for a time and then said, mostly to himself, as if he had said it or thought it many times before,
"I don't know what's going to become of me when it happens. Maybe there are no plans for me at all."
"Are you sure you're not throwing 6 different theories up into the air to see which lands first?" I said. "I can tell theories when I hear them, speculation. You don't know, do you?"
"No,"
Nicholas admitted. "How long have you had this one?"
"I don't know. They're all written down."
"In order of descending merit?"
"In the order they came to me."
"And each one," I said to him, "seemed equally true to you at the time." Nicholas said,
"One of them has to be true. Finally, I'll find it. I have to." "You could go to your grave not knowing," Rachel said. "I'll understand it eventually," Nicholas said doggedly.
Maybe not, I thought. Maybe she is right. Nicholas could flounder around forever, his stack of typed papers constantly growing with theory after theory, each one more lurid than the last, more comprehensive, more daring. Finally, the man slumbering within him, whom they were attempting to arouse back into wakeful life, could appear, take charge, and finish Nicholas's thesis for him.
Nicholas could write, I wonder if it's... It may be that... I'm sure that... It has to be... And then the ancient man could rise into life and write down, He was correct. It is. I am.
The thing that has worried me, Rachel said, whenever you talk like this, is what will he be like to me and Johnny if they're able to waken him? And I guess tonight shows that he'll take care of Johnny.
With more than I can, Nicholas said. You're not going to fight, I said. You're just going to let it take you over? Nicholas said,
I'm looking forward to it.
To Rachel, I said, Are there any vacant apartments in your building? I was thinking to myself that as a freelance writer, I could live anywhere. I didn't have to remain in the Bay Area. Smiling a little, Rachel said,
You think he should be down here to help take care of him?
Something like that, I said.